had wanted a good badge after leaving the BCA and had grabbed the first one offered. He really didn't mind the temporary isolation. He thought that would break down in time. But he'd surprised himself with the feeling that he was seriously adrift. From his first day as a Minneapolis cop, he'd worked to understand his environment. He'd eventually understood Minneapolis-St. Paul and its population of bad people. If someone told him that an unknown X had murdered a known Y, he'd usually know a Z that he could talk to begin figuring out what had happened. That wasn't always true, but it was true often enough to give him a clearance rate that nobody in the department could touch. When he'd moved to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, a statewide organization, he'd struggled toward the same kind of comprehensive understanding, but this time of the entire state of Minnesota. He'd never gotten as comfortable with the state as he had with the metro area, but he'd worked at it. As part of that, he'd developed a database of shady individuals with whom he'd pounded out private understandings. He'd call, they'd talk. If they got in trouble themselves, Lucas would have a chat with a judge as long as the trouble was minor. With the help of other agents, he'd eventually put together a roster of snitches with at least a couple of names in every single Minnesota county, and for larger cities like Duluth or Rochester, he had an entire roll call. Included in the database were several dozen cops who formed a web of personal relationships tight enough that Lucas could get help anywhere in the state at any time. Even in his new job as a deputy marshal, he was taking calls from BCA agents who wanted into his database. "Who do you have in Alexandria who might know about the Chicle coming across from Canada?" Didn't work that way with the marshal service. His jurisdiction was the United States of America, including the various territories. There was no possibility of comprehending it in any real way. He'd fallen into a morass. He could call for help from the FBI, the DEA, the Border Patrol, all the alphabet agencies enforcing the nation's laws, but he didn't know the individuals. He couldn't count on them. They were just voices on the far end of a cell phone call and would get around to helping him as their own schedules permitted. He didn't know the bad guys at all or who were the baddest. He was, as his wife Weather had said, out there on his lonesome, and he didn't understand the out there. Hal Oder, the marshal for the district, resented Lucas's independent status. Lucas took no orders or assignments from Oder, and, to Oder, had looked like a job threat. That hadn't eased, even though Lucas made it clear that he had no interest at all in Oder's job. "I hate the shit you have to put up with," Lucas told the other man. "I wouldn't do it. I'd quit first. All I want to do is hunt. The bureaucratic bullshit is the reason I quit the BCA. "Just hunt. That's right. If you screw up, it'll make this office look bad," Oder had said. "I might screw up, but if I do, I'll make it clear that it has nothing to do with you or your office, that my people are in Washington, not in Minnesota," Lucas had said. "Who's your contact in Washington?" "Russell Fort," Lucas said. "Don't know him," Oder said. "Are you sure he'll be happy to take the responsibility if you mess up?" "Well, he is a bureaucrat. You'd know more than me about the likelihood of his taking the blame." Oder had been tapping on a legal pad with a mechanical pencil. He thought about Lucas's comment, then said, "Look, Lucas, I know what happened when you quit the BCA, and I'm up to date with what happened down in Iowa. You saved Mrs. Bowden's life, and you got a badge because of it. The way it looks, she's going to be president, and I don't want to fight with a friend of Bowden. But I feel like I'm stuck in the middle. I don't want to get blamed for things I don't do. But when you fuck up, and you will, it's inevitable with the job, I'll get blamed. I hate that. I won't be a problem, Lucas promised. You'll hardly ever see me around the place. Oder had seemed to accept that, but in the way of bureaucrats, he let it be known that Davenport was not really one of us. In an effort to further smooth things over, Lucas had offered to help out in unusual situations. The Minnesota Marshal's office was perpetually shorthanded, and that was how he'd wound up as a rich guy decoy in Missouri. Lucas and another deputy had also run down an embezzler who'd skipped his date in Minneapolis federal court in favor of a new name and a new home in Idaho, and had recovered a chunk of the embezzled cash from an Idaho safe deposit box which had made everyone look good. He'd helped locate, with his Minnesota database, a redneck who didn't like federal wildlife laws and had decided to eliminate wolves and eagles in his personal hunting grounds. The guy'd been busted by the Fish and Wildlife Service, but had forfeited a $2,500 bond rather than show up for trial in federal court. He'd told acquaintances that the feds would take him when they pried my cold dead hands off his black rifle, and had suggested that he was polishing up a special bullet for the U.S. attorney. Lucas and two other deputies had hauled his ass out of a bar in Grand Marais, blubbering about his rights. They were good arrests, but not what Lucas had been looking for. Still, he'd been useful enough that he and Carl Meadows, the chief deputy, had begun taking an occasional lunch together. The day after he returned from St. Louis, a bright and cool autumn Monday in Minneapolis, he and Meadows walked over to the food trucks on 2nd Avenue and bought brats, and Lucas told the other man about the Missouri sting.
"That's all good," Meadows said when Lucas finished. "But have you found anything to dig into? You've been sitting in your ass for a while."
"I know, but I might be onto something now," Lucas said. "Have you ever heard of a guy named Garvin Poole?" Meadows frowned and looked down at his brat as though it might hold an answer.
"The name rings a bell back a while, but I can't place it. Maybe a southerner? He was on our top 15 list for a while."
"Yeah. Everything I know came out of a conversation with Jim Duffy down in St. Louis and what I fished out of the online records this morning. Poole was an old-style hold-up man down in the southeast. Georgia, South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, North Florida. Came out of Tennessee originally, but didn't operate much there, at least not after he did 4 years in a Tennessee prison. He dropped out of sight 5 years ago. He was tentatively identified in an armored car robbery in Chattanooga, and nothing after that. A lot of his pals have been busted in question, but they all agree that he's gone. Nobody knows where. A lot of people thought he was dead. Then 10 days ago, a dope counting house down in Biloxi was knocked over. The robbers killed 5 people, including a 6-year-old girl."
"Yeah, geez, I heard about that. That's ugly," Meadows said.
"One of the victims apparently got off a shot before he was killed," Lucas said. "The crime scene people found a few drops of blood, ran it through the DNA database, and got a hit. They think it was Poole."
"Think?
DNA's supposed to be for sure," Meadows said.
"Not this time," Lucas said.
"The DNA match came from the armored car robbery in Chattanooga. The truck had internal cameras that the robbers couldn't get at. The video showed one of the robbers banging his forearm against a doorframe when he was climbing out of the truck with a bag of cash. They got some skin off the frame, ran the DNA. They didn't get a hit, but believe it was Poole on the basis of height and body type and the robbery technique. They couldn't see his face, and he was wearing gloves, so there's no fingerprints, no definitive ID. Both drivers were shot to death with .40-caliber handguns, as were the 5 people killed in Biloxi. Poole favors .40-caliber Glocks."
"Same as we carry," Yeah, well, you, anyway. Lucas carried his own .45, which was against regulations, but nobody had tried to argue with him about that. Any federal warrants on him? Meadows asked. Old ones, but still good. 9 years ago, he and a guy named Charles Trevino robbed a mail truck out of St. Petersburg, Lucas said. The truck was carrying a bunch of registered mail packages after a stamp collector's convention. Trevino was busted a year later when he tried to unload some of the stamps. He said Poole was the other guy, and there was a third guy whom he didn't know who did the research and the setup. The U.S. attorney filed an indictment on Poole, and a warrant was issued, but he hasn't been picked up since then. Sounds like a smart guy who works with other smart guys if they spotted a particular mail truck full of old stamps, Meadows said. Apparently he is a smart guy, besides being a cold-blooded killer, Lucas said. That's one of the reasons he interests me, that and the little girl. You've got a daughter, right? Meadows asked. 3 of them, Lucas said. One's going to college, one's about to go, and I've got a 5-year-old, a son, too. Huh. Here's a change of direction, Meadows said. You hear that Sandy Park got hit by a bicyclist? Sandra Park was another deputy marshal. Lucas had nodded to her in the hallway. What, a bicycle? Yeah. Jerk on one of those fat-tire mountain bikes rolling down a hill blew through a stop sign. Sandy was out jogging and got T-boned. Anyway, she's not hurt bad, but one ankle and one knee are messed up. She's going to be off them for a couple of weeks. She's good with computers. If you need some backup, she knows all the law enforcement systems inside and out. I can tell her to give your questions a priority if you need that, Meadows said. Thanks, Lucas said. I'll talk to her this afternoon. I'll tell her you're coming around. Lucas talked to Park and found himself smoothing more ruffled feathers. Park was not being asked to do secretarial-type work because she was a woman. She was being asked to do it because Lucas didn't know how. She had expertise that he didn't, and she was working while injured, and because blah, blah, blah. Feathers smoothed, Lucas asked her to dredge up everything she could find in the federal systems on Poole. Park said she would, and would have a brick of paper and a flash drive by the next day. That night, Lucas told Weather about Poole. He's an old-fashioned kind of crook. Guns and holdups, armored cars and banks, or anywhere else that has cash. He likes cash. He held up the box office at a country music show one time. Doesn't have a problem with killing people. Doesn't do anything high-tech. He told her about the little girl killed in Biloxi, and she shook her head. Brutal. Yeah. They both glanced toward their daughter, Gabrielle, who was sitting on a corner chair going through a beginning reader book with a fierce concentration, paying no attention to her parents. You could be going out of town for a while, Weather said. They were sitting on the front room couch, her head on his shoulder. Weather was a short woman, a plastic surgeon, pretty, with cool eyes and a nose she thought overlarge, but Lucas thought was striking. I could be. No longer than I have to be, but it could be a couple of weeks. I don't think a month. I'll probably drive instead of flying, Lucas said. He got up and wandered around the living room, looking at books, putting them down, thinking about it. Not your part of the country, she said. That southern thing is different. I know. You think this could really interest you? She asked. If a guy is bad enough, he'll interest me. Poole is bad, and nobody's been able to lay hands on him. A challenge, she said. Yeah. Weather said, I don't like the idea of you going away too often, but it's better than having you sitting around, brooding. You're getting to be a pain in the ass. Lucas nodded. I get that way when I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Hunting. Yes. Lucas called Russell Fort the next morning to tell him what he was planning to do. Fort worked at the U.S. Marshal's Office headquarters in Virginia, across the Potomac from Washington, D.C.
"I remember Poole," Fort said. "He was on our top 15 list for a long time. We let him drift off because we had nothing to work with. If you find him, that'd be a major feather in your cap. All of our caps. Do not try to take him alone. He's a killer. The first sniff you get, call me, and we'll get you a team from the Special Operations Group."
"I will do that," Lucas said. Later at the federal building, he found Park standing over a hot printer, putting what looked like a ream of paper between hard covers.
"There's more," she said. "This is the good stuff so far. I was reading through it while I dug it out, and I'll tell you, Lucas, Poole started out as a mean kid, and he stayed that way. His father worked off and on for the state of Tennessee, different low-level jobs, but he was also a small-time crook. Got busted for scalping tickets, once for selling driver's licenses out of the DMV where he worked, but he was acquitted on that and got his job back. Was arrested a couple of times for selling stolen merchandise, but never convicted. His sister supposedly boosted a truckload of racing tires one time, but the charges were dropped. Doesn't say why. Garvin stepped up from that, but he didn't come from the best of families."
"His folks still alive?" Lucas asked.
"Don't know, but I suppose so. Poole's only 42 if he's not dead himself," Park said. "I could find out."
"Do that, and print it all," Lucas said. "If there's anything on the parents and any brothers and sisters, I'll want it. Files on any associates, girlfriends, everything." Park patted the Xerox machine.
"I'll do it, as long as this machine doesn't break down."
When Park finished, she handed Lucas a couple of reams of paper that must have weighed 10 pounds. Lucas took it home and settled into his den to read. First up were crime scene photos out of Biloxi. Lucas had seen thousands of crime scene photos over his career, and these were nothing like the worst. All 5 victims had been shot in the head and had died instantly. One of them, the little girl, looked like a plastic doll lying spread-eagled on a concrete floor, face up, a hole in her forehead like a third eye. She was wearing a white dress with lace, full at the knees. Lucas had seen a lot of pictures of dead kids. He glanced at the photo and then went on to the next. And yet, he kept coming back to it. The little girl had been connected by DNA to one of the other counting house victims, a much older man. The DNA analyst said she was his granddaughter. The grandfather may have been a dope-selling asshole, but the girl wasn't. In the photo, she was lying flat on her back, her eyes half open. They still shone with the innocence of the very young, and with the surprise of how their lives had ended so early. The dress had something to do with it, too. It reminded Lucas of the dresses worn by Catholic schoolmates, little girls going off to First Communion. Crime scene techs had found a smear of blood on the dress, where somebody, had to be one of the killers, had ripped off a piece, probably to use as a bandage. The girl on the floor began to work on him. He made a call to Biloxi, found that nobody had claimed any of the bodies.
"We don't really expect anybody to show up and say, 'Yeah, I'm with all those dope guys, we want to give them a nice church funeral.'"
Now Lucas began to feel something of a personal hook. Get the guy who'd killed this little girl. He hadn't had to, but he'd done it anyway. Why? Maybe the simple efficiency. Maybe she'd seen the killer's face and would be able to identify him. Maybe because the shooter or shooters just liked killing people. Pissed him off in a technical cop way. At the same time, despite the growing spark of anger, Lucas thought, good shooting. The killer, whether it was Poole or not, was a pro. Efficient, well-schooled, remorseless. Lucas put the photos aside, all but the one of the girl. He kicked back at his desk, looked at that for a final minute or two, then flicked it onto the pile of other photos. Neither the photos nor the investigation reports told him much, possibly because there wasn't much to tell other than what he could see for himself. The Mississippi Bureau of Investigation had handled much of the work and had done it professionally enough. When Lucas had finished reading through the reports, he called the MBI agent who'd signed off on them. It took a few minutes to get through the MBI phone system. Then Elroy Martin picked up the phone and said, "This is Martin." Lucas identified himself and said, "I'm looking into this because of his federal fugitive status. I've got all your reports, unless there's something new since yesterday." "There isn't," Martin said. "So what do you think?" "If you can find Poole, the DNA will take him down. I'm positive of that. But finding him is the problem. People have been chasing him for years. Good people. Guys who knew what they were doing." "Your notes say you didn't think he did the Biloxi thing on his own." "That's right. We don't know how many were on the job, but I don't believe it would be less than two or three. The five dead were killed with two different guns, both .40 caliber. All the slugs and brass came out of the same batch, and all were reloads. It seems possible that two shooters would share a batch of ammo, but, you know, probably not." "Yeah, probably not. Whoever did this had to spot that drug-counting house, that's what it was, and we don't think it was Poole. We think it was probably somebody who knew about the counting house from a drug connection, maybe because he lives around there in Biloxi," Martin said. "It's possible that it was a professional spotter, a planner, a setup guy. We know he used a setup guy in the stamp robbery. We don't think Poole would touch anything where he lives because he'd know that we'd be all over it. We think he was brought in as the shooter. We don't have any idea of who the spotter was, though." "Maybe somebody in the cartel who decided he wanted a bigger piece of the action and decided to take it?" "We talked about that, but then why bring in Poole? That Biloxi drug stuff comes through a Honduras cartel, a real professional operation," Martin said. "If you're in that cartel, you'd know plenty of guys with guns, but you wouldn't know Poole. Poole's not a drug guy, he's a Dixie Hicks guy. A hold-up man. Completely different set of bad guys. They really don't intersect." "Huh. If we could find the spotter, that'd be a big step," Lucas said. "Yeah, it would, but we haven't come up with anything yet," Martin said. "We'd do anything we could to get our hands on Poole. We think he killed one of our guys a few years ago." "I saw that." They talked a few more minutes, but Lucas got the impression that Mississippi was running out of possibilities. He thanked Martin and went back to the paper on his desk. Poole first ran into the law when he was 11 years old, after a schoolyard fight. Unlike most schoolyard fights, this wasn't two punches with the loser swearing to get the other guy. Poole knocked the loser down, then kicked him in the face and ribs and back until a teacher dragged him off. The loser went to the hospital in an ambulance. There were no more fights until high school. Then there was only one with the same result. The loser went to the hospital. A witness told a juvenile court that Poole had gone psycho. Poole, who'd been a running back on the junior high and then sophomore football teams, was kicked out of school. A few weeks later, he held up a dry cleaner's with a toy pistol. The dry cleaner had a lot of cash and no protection at all. Poole hadn't gone after a place that might be ready for him, like a liquor store or a convenience store. The holdup also demonstrated his youthful inexperience. Although he'd picked on a store well north of his home in a Nashville suburb, he hadn't known about video cameras, and two cameras were mounted on a Dunkin' Donuts store in the same shopping center and picked up Poole's face.
He looked very young, and the cops took photos around to the high schools and arrested Poole the same day as he'd done the robbery, with most of the money still in his pocket. He was sent to the Mountain View Youth Development Center, where he spent 9 months working the wood shop and talking to other teenage felons about the best way to proceed with a life of crime. 3 years after his release, he was arrested again after he and two other men cut through a roof into the box office of a country music venue and robbed it. They got away with $110,000, but one of the men, Boyd Harper, had an angry girlfriend named Retta Ann Joyce, who ratted out Harper to the cops. She did that after learning Harper had spent $30,000, virtually his entire cut of the country music money, on cocaine and hookers, and she hadn't been invited. She had, however, contracted a fiery case of gonorrhea passed on from one of the hookers, and not, as Harper tried to tell her, from a toilet seat. Harper, in turn, ratted out Poole and an accomplice named Dave Edelstein in return for a shorter sentence. Poole and Edelstein did 4 years at West Tennessee State Prison. Harper got only a year and a day at Southeastern Tennessee Regional Correctional Facility, where he studied culinary arts. He'd served only 4 months when a person unknown stuck the sharpened butt of a dinner fork into his heart. Poole and Edelstein couldn't have done that themselves, but Tennessee state cops believed that they paid for the killing through a contractual arrangement between Tennessee prison gangs. They also believed that Poole and or Edelstein might have had something to do with the demise of Retta Ann Joyce, who either jumped or was thrown off the New River Railroad Bridge a month after the two men were released from prison. They believed she was thrown because of the rope around her neck. The rope might possibly have shown some intention to commit suicide, except that suicides rarely use mountain climbing ropes 110 feet long. Joyce's neck hit the bottom of the noose so hard that her head popped off. The head wasn't found until 2 weeks after the body, a half mile farther down the New River Gorge, washed up on a sandbar. Lucas, looking at the riverbank crime scene photo of Joyce's head, muttered, "That's not nice." Poole had not been arrested again, but was widely understood by state and federal law enforcement officials to have been a prime mover of the Dixie Hicks, a loose confederation of hold-up men working the lower tier of Confederate states. He was also believed by the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation to have murdered a highway patrolman named Richard Wayne Coons, shot one night on Lonely Highway 21 between Bogachito and Sugarlock, Mississippi. The cops got his name from Al Jim Hudson, who said in a deathbed confession that he was in the car when Poole shot Coons. Hudson died shortly thereafter of internal injuries he had suffered while resisting arrest. FBI intelligence agents learned from a source unnamed in Lucas's papers that Poole had eventually accumulated over $1 million in gold, maybe well over a million, on which he intended to retire to Mexico or Belize. Neither the Mexican nor the Belize cops ever got a sniff of him. Not that they admitted to, anyway. Lucas knew nothing about Belize cops, but he had met a high-level Mexican police intelligence officer and had been impressed. If the Mexicans didn't know about Poole, he probably wasn't in Mexico. Then rumors began to circulate that Poole had been murdered by a Dixie Hicks rival named Ralph Booger Baca. According to the source, Baca threw Poole's body into the Four-Hole Swamp in South Carolina, from which it was never recovered. A few months after he allegedly murdered Poole, Baca died in a freak accident when he turned the key on his Harley-Davidson and the Fat Bob extra-capacity tanks inexplicably exploded in his face, turning Baca into a human torch. He lingered, but not long.
Poole had not been seen or heard of again until the killings in Biloxi, if in fact that was Poole at all. Whether or not it was, Lucas thought, people died around Poole, both his friends and his enemies, including one little girl who had the bad luck to have a dope dealer as a grandfather. But if the DNA and video camera connection was correct, Poole wasn't dead. Not yet. In reading through Poole's history, Lucas found several notes by a retired MBI investigator named Rory Pratt. Lucas got a number from the MBI and called him. "Tracked him all over the South," Pratt said in a deep Mississippi accent. "We didn't always know who or what we were chasing. But we weren't gonna quit after Dick Coons got shot down. That was as cold-blooded a killing as you're likely to find. We looked at everything, but it was like chasing a shadow. We'd hear rumors that he had been involved in a robbery at such and such a place, and we'd be there the next day. Never really got hold of anything solid. We talked to guys who were actually involved in some of these holdups, but they always denied knowing Poole. Being of that element, they knew what had happened to people who had talked about Poole. You get any feel for whether he was actually involved in any of the robberies you checked? Lucas asked. A lot of people think he's dead. He's not dead. I guarantee that. Not unless someone snuck up behind him and shot him and buried the body in the dark of the moon and never told anyone. Another thing is, he's got a girlfriend named Pandora Box. I read that, but I thought it was a joke, Lucas said. No joke. I mean, I guess it was a joke by her daddy, but that's where the joke ended, Pratt said. There's a story that Poole once caught up with a guy from the Banditas who stiffed him on a money deal. One thing led to another, and Box cut the Bandito's head off with a carving knife for no reason except that she could. No proof of that, no witnesses we know of, but that's the story. Anyway, Box disappeared at the same time as Poole. But 2 years ago, she went to an uncle's funeral up in Tennessee. We didn't find out until a week later. People around there keep their mouths shut. If Box and Poole disappeared at the same time and she's still alive and even looking prosperous, you see where I'm going here? Did anyone check the airlines, see where she was coming in from or going back to? They did. She didn't fly in or out. She came to the funeral in a taxi and left the same way. We think she probably drove from wherever they're hiding and then caught a cab so nobody would see her car. The uncle's funeral was 4 days after he died, so she could have driven from anywhere in the lower 48. Gotcha. Listen, if you'd have time, put together an email on what you and your partner did. Not every little thing, but in general, and what you think, Lucas said. Mostly what you think. Any hints or suggestions about how I might do this? I got one hint right now. If they get on top of you, you gotta shoot your way through, Marshal. Surrendering or negotiating will get you killed, Pratt said. Even get your head cut off. That boy is a gall-darned cottonmouth pit viper. And so is his girlfriend. Back in the paper, Lucas made up a list of known associates, and in particular, people who actually seemed to be friends of Poole. He included Poole's parents and sister. Dora Box apparently had no living relatives. When he was finished, he had 22 names. He emailed the list to Sandy Park, the deputy marshal who'd done the computer research, and asked for reports on those people. That done, he called the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation and talked to the head of the Criminal Investigation Division. "I wanted to tell you that I'm coming through and let you know what I'm doing," Lucas said. The agent, Justin Adams, knew Poole's name and some of the details from the Biloxi murders.
You think you've found him? Give me a call and we'll be there. You want somebody to go around with you?
Maybe later, Lucas said. First thing up, I'm going to be talking to his parents and sister and that kind of thing. I don't expect too much. If I get into something, though, I'll let you know.
Sandy Park got back late in the afternoon with the results on the list of people who were friends or accomplices of Poole. Of the 22 on the list, 9 were dead. Some because they'd simply gotten cancer or had gotten old, like Box's parents, while 3 had died violently. 2 shot during robberies, 1 in a motorcycle accident. Dora Box's sister had committed suicide after a long run on heroin. Of those still alive, 8 were in prison, mostly serving life terms as career criminals. 1 was on death row in Alabama. Of the other 5, Lucas got addresses for 3. Nothing was known about the location of the other 2. An email came in from Pratt, the retired MBI investigator, with a few details that hadn't been in the formal paperwork. Poole knew how to create different looks for himself. He'd dyed his hair at one time or another, had been both clean-shaven and bearded. Sometimes lounged in jeans and boots and working men's T-shirts, and sometimes appeared in expensive suits and ties. Sometimes he had white sidewalls, sometimes hair on his shoulders.
"One thing is always the same," Pratt said. "He always shoots first."
Lucas spent 2 days with his son Sam at his Wisconsin cabin, cleaning it up and getting ready to shut it down for the winter. Sam was 8, skipping school and loving it. They went fishing for an hour or two in the morning, and Sam caught his first muskie, a 30-incher. Lucas was more excited than the kid was. Not only was it a muskie, but the kid was being imprinted with a certain kind of lifestyle. The love of a quiet lake in the early morning. Lucas showed him how to support the muskie in the water, take the hook out with a pair of pliers, then release the fish back into the deep. As they were washing the fish stink off their hands in the lake water, Sam said, "The best thing I've ever done in my whole life." At night, they watched a little satellite TV, and Lucas continued working through the Poole file. Done at the cabin, they drove back to the cities, and Lucas told Weather he was leaving the following Sunday for Nashville. He wanted a full week to begin with all the government law enforcement offices open for business.
"How long will you be gone?" she asked. "Best estimate?"
"I'll leave Sunday evening, make a short day of it, get to Nashville the next day. I should know in the first week or two if there's any chance of locating him. If I get a sniff of him, could be 2 or 3 weeks.
"Why do you think you can find Poole when nobody else can?" she asked.
They were in the kitchen loading up the dishwasher. Sam was out in the garage, and they could hear him knocking a wiffle ball around with a cut-down hockey stick. "If he's alive, he can be found," Lucas said. "There'll be people who know where he is, or at least how to get in touch with him. If he was the shooter in Biloxi, at least one guy knows where to find him, the guy who spotted the counting house. If I can squeeze between that guy and Poole, I'll get him." She closed the dishwasher, pushed the programming buttons, then leaned back against it and said,
"Don't be too confident. It could get you killed."
"I'll be as careful as I know how. The guy's a cold-blooded killer." Lucas smiled at her, the Wolverine smile.
"The best kind." "God help you, Lucas," she said.
Chapter 4.
Luis Soto was a bad man and liked being a bad man. The badness rolled off him like a malaria sweat. A mean little rat bastard who could walk into a bar and order a shot of Reposado Gold, and everybody in the bar would figure him for a gun and a razor and an eagerness to use them. He'd been born in Miami, and not a good part of Miami, of Cuban immigrant parents, and started his career in crime as a driver and muscle for a loan shark. He'd also burned a few buildings down for people who needed their buildings burned down, had laundered money through the Florida Indian casinos for his various bosses, had provided protection for a smuggling operation that brought Iranian turquoise in from the Bahamas. He'd spent some time robbing tourists in Miami Beach and had been caught a few times because he wasn't the brightest. He'd been described by a Miami detective as our all-purpose asshole. His life had changed when he got in an argument in a parking lot of a chili bar in San Cristobal, Florida, and had cut the best part of the nose off a Jepson County, Florida sheriff's deputy after the deputy had called him a nigger of the spick persuasion. The deputy had been in civilian clothing, and Soto hadn't known he was a cop, but that wouldn't have stopped him anyway. He would have known that he was probably causing himself more trouble than the cutting was worth, but a man had his pride, and so he cut the deputy. He was right about the trouble. He was carefully and thoroughly beaten for 30 consecutive nights in the Jepson County Jail and hadn't been able to walk quite straight or fuck anything at all since performing that traumatic nose job. The jailers also spent some time jerking him around on the end of a dog collar, leaving him with a rough, high-pitched voice that sounded like a crow scratching on a tin roof. When Soto got back to Miami from Jepson County, he couldn't run or lift anything too heavy and had finally taken up killing people for a living. He got anything between $1,500 and $10,000 per murder, whatever the traffic would bear. His primo client was a Honduras drug cartel, his specific employer, a man he knew only as The Boss, with a capital B. The Boss would provide a succinct explanation of why the designated murderee needed to be dead and where he was, and Soto would set up the kill and carry it out. Most of the murders weren't exactly masterworks of subterfuge. Soto would pull up to the victim's front door, knock, and when the guy answered, fill him full of 9mm jacketed hollow points. The pistol, of course, was silenced. Not silent, but quiet enough in those neighborhoods disinclined to ask about loud, sharp noises. A day or two later, $10,000 would show up in Soto's Panama City bank account. The Panama City in the county of Panama. A few of the kills were more complicated and also paid better. Those were the punishment murders. Soto would track the miscreant and, at an opportune moment, kidnap him or, occasionally, her. He didn't do the punishment himself. That was done by his partner. Bad as Soto was, he was nothing like the nightmare of Charlene Court. Court didn't live her life. She suffered it. She suffered it right from the beginning. Born to a long line of white trash and being fat and greasy, she had a bad time in school from her elementary years right through 2 years of high school. She made it all worse with a meth habit that started in seventh grade when her parents began cooking it. She'd once gotten dressed up to apply for a job and asked her tweaker father how she looked. He'd said, "Like you caught on fire and somebody stomped you out with golf shoes." He really thought he was being funny. With 28 years of unrelieved poverty and bitterness following her like an incurable disease, she'd found her calling when she murdered an assistant manager at the dollar store where she was working the overnight shift as a stock girl. The assistant manager, whose name was Dan Bird, delighted in giving her a hard time. She didn't work fast, she didn't work smart, she wasn't even clean enough for the dollar store.
When did you last wash your hair anyway, dirt girl? Even if you don't respect yourself, you gotta respect the store, you hear me?
Bird had gotten drunk and had done a late-night surprise drop-in to make sure she was hard at work. He was running his mouth on that subject as Court was unpacking an iron.
You gotta work fast and you gotta work smart. You don't do either one, do you, dirt girl? You wanna know why? You're dumb trailer trash, white trash, trash. That's why.
He got a step too close, and she clocked him with the iron, knocking him on his drunken ass. Knowing the job was all over for her anyway, she hit him several more times with the edge of the iron until his skull started to get mushy and took intense, absolute sexual pleasure as she watched him shake and tremble and groan and bleed. After a while, having thought about how much fun this was, she walked over to the hardware section and got a pair of wire cutters, a drywall saw, a hammer, and a contractor's trash bag. She stuffed him in the bag, dragged him out to his own car, drove him down to a nearby river landing where she sometimes went to smoke her meth, and tore him apart with her tools. When he was dead, which took a while, his body went in the river. His car was parked behind an adult pleasures outlet, and Court walked back to the dollar store to clean up the bloody mess on the floor and to wait the arrival of the cops. The cops finally had come, she had heard, but nobody talked to her, and eventually no more was said about the disappearance of Dan Bird. She'd gotten away with murder without even trying. Given her contacts in the world of backwoods meth feuds, her newfound skills and murderous enthusiasm were definitely marketable. Nobody knew exactly what she'd done, but the word had gotten around that Charlene Court was the meanest bitch in North Florida, which put her high on the list for meanest bitch worldwide. Court moved on from hammers and drywall, though the extra-large side cutters still had a place in her tool bag, when she discovered the wonderful world of electricity and all those battery-powered Japanese saws and drills and nail drivers. Her redneck employers called her the Queen of Home Improvement Tools. Then one day, 2 years after she killed Dan Bird, her employers hooked her up with Soto, who had contacts sideways across the Gulf of Mexico, where all the money was. Soto killed people, which was a valuable skill, but combined with Court's interest in the pain of other people, they made an even more valuable team. That, despite the fact that they'd hated each other at first sight, the gimpy Cuban and the overweight white trash girl. Soto didn't like Court any more than anyone else had, and Court sensed that from the first moment she got in his car. On this occasion, they met in Panama City, the one in North Florida, at Allegra's Fine Pizza and Pasta, a place with checkered plastic tablecloths, plastic baskets of supermarket rolls, and frozen pizza and pasta lightly heated in microwave ovens. They got a booth with a view of the building across the alley.
"It's complicated," Soto told Court. "This is punishment, but we also gotta get some information. We can't cut them up and leave."
"What's the deal?" Court asked. Soto's head bobbed and turned, constantly checking the environment, maybe looking for strange guns. He reminded Court of a bobblehead doll with a mean streak.
"Somebody robbed the boss's bank," Soto said. "He wants the money back, and he wants the robbers punished. If we could get the money back, we could get $250,000 each. If we don't get the money back, but punish these guys, we get $20,000 each.
So it's mostly about the money."
"Always is," Soto said.
"I'd like $250,000, Court said. She thought about it and asked, "What if we can't find him and we get nothing back?"
"Then we get nothing, but they pick up all the expenses."
They know who robbed them? Cort asked as she sucked down a Mexican Coca-Cola.
The colored-sounding guy says it's probably a man named Garvin Poole. He's a hold-up man and killer.
The cops have been looking for him for 10 years, Soto said. Problem is, nobody knows where Poole's at. They do know he's probably got his girlfriend with him. Her name is Dora Box.
How are we gonna find them? Cort asked. We're not the cops.
The colored-sounding guy is going to help out. He's in all the cop files. The thing is, Poole can't be found, but his relatives are out there like sitting ducks. That's where you come in.
Cort nodded and said, okay, gonna have to think about it, maybe read up some.
Read up? What's to read up about?
He didn't quite sneer at the idea. On the other jobs, the boss just wanted somebody hurt bad so the word would get around. We didn't care when the sucker died. If we need to get some information out of somebody, I'm gonna have to be more careful, stretch it out.
Makes you kinda hot, doesn't it? Thinking about it,
Soto said.
You ever been laid?
Fuck you, Cort said. She sucked the last of the coke out of the bottle, pulled the straw out and crumpled it in her fist, pushed it back in the bottle. She didn't know why she did that, but always had. When do we get the names?
Any time now. The colored-sounding guy says he has to do some research. Shouldn't take long. Go rent a car. I'll let you know. Ought to be ready to roll tonight.
The college-sounding guy was a computer hacker also employed by the boss, and who had valuable entree to almost any police files, and lots of other files as well. He'd gotten a half-dozen fake IDs for both Cort and Soto, and credit cards that actually worked for 2 months. The amounts they paid for his services were fairly small, a few hundred to a couple of $1,000 each time, which made Cort think that he might have a lot of accounts. They had a phone number for him and nothing else. Cort imagined him sitting in his mother's basement, lots of shadows around, surrounded by Orange Crush bottles and sacks of Cheetos. In real life, when they called, he was usually listening to soft rock music like Genesis or somebody. When they called the boss, on the other hand, there was no sound but the boss's baritone voice and a very faint electronic twittering. Cort didn't mind talking to the college-sounding guy because he had a workaday voice and casual attitude. Pay me the money and I'll get you the information. The boss, on the other hand, was remote and disembodied and extremely courteous, and for that reason, mysterious and threatening. Cort and Soto left the restaurant separately, Soto going first. They'd rent cars for the job, although the cars they rented wouldn't be used on the job. They'd rent a different set of cars for that. Lots of cars meant lots of ways out, if the shit hit the fan. Cort got hers at the airport, drove to her apartment, 40 minutes away, threw everything out of the refrigerator but some bottles of water, took the garbage around back to a dumpster. That done, she watched a couple of hours of television and was getting into a Friends rerun when Soto called.
We're going to Tennessee. I'll see you there tomorrow night in Nashville. About an 8-hour drive. You get a car?
Yes.
The college-sounding guy made reservations for you at the Best Western at the Nashville airport under the Sally Thomas name.
I'll call you when I get in, Cort said. She rang off and went to her computer. Time to do a little research. Soto had been right about one thing. Thinking about the job did get her a little hot. Chapter 5 Lucas left St. Paul after dinner on Sunday, driving into the rising moon. As a night owl, he didn't mind driving past midnight, as long as he had a motel reservation. He took that one short day, plus most of Monday, to get to Nashville, watching the autumn leaves turn from yellow and red in Minnesota and Wisconsin back to a dusty green by the time he crossed the Tennessee border. He'd never been to Nashville. The name to him mostly meant shit-kicker music, whining violins and frog-plunk banjos, and, if anything, he was a rocker. The country music he did like mostly came from a line that might be drawn from Bakersfield, California, to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Jacksonville, Florida, and south of that. In other words, not the Grand Ole Opry or anything involving the Appalachians or moonshine or whatever happens when you cross the Harlan County line. A few minutes before 6 o'clock, he pulled into a La Quinta Inn off I-24, 20 miles south of Nashville, checked in, took a leak, washed his face, changed into a suit, tie, and black Oxfords, a high-end cop look, and then drove northeast into the town of La Verne, where he cruised past the home of Poole's parents. Kevin and Marjorie Poole lived in a beige two-story house with vinyl siding, few windows, a single-car garage, and a burned-out lawn. The sun had hit the horizon in the west, and the evening was coming on, but no lights were showing in the house. There was a car parked in the driveway, not quite straight, as if it had been left in a hurry, or the driver was a little drunk. Lucas parked in the street and went to the door and rang the bell. No answer. He didn't want to linger, maybe warn somebody off, so he went back to his truck. As he started it up, he noticed a heavyset woman standing behind a screen door in the house across the street. Her arms were crossed in a defensive pose. Either the self-appointed neighborhood watch or somebody to rat him out to the Pools. He drove back to the La Quinta thinking about food. A couple of Tennessee Highway Patrol cars were parked at the motel entrance, the two troopers talking to a bearded man who stood outside an aged Ford pickup. The pickup had a camper back and a bumper sticker on the driver's side that said "Vegetarian" over a green marijuana leaf, and on the passenger side, another sticker that said, "Can't we just all get a bong?" The bearded man had a battered guitar case at his feet, but was not Willie Nelson. Lucas nodded at the cops as he went by, and one of the troopers called after him.
"Excuse me, sir."
And Lucas turned, and the two troopers were looking at him, their hands on their Glocks. The taller of the two asked,
"Are you carrying a gun?"
Lucas's .45 had printed through the jacket. He said,
"Yes, I'm a U.S. Marshal. I have an ID in my pocket on the right side of my jacket."
The cops nodded, and Lucas pulled open his jacket with the fingertips of his right hand, extracted his badge case with his left hand, and dropped it open. The shorter trooper looked at it and said,
"Good enough for me."
And then,
"Minnesota?"
"Yeah, I'm down here looking for a guy," Lucas said. The tall trooper hooked a thumb at the guitar player and said,
"It wouldn't be Rory Harris, would it?"
"Nope, he's your problem," the bearded man said.
"I know my rights,"
the tall trooper said.
"And it's your right to get stopped every 2 miles and asked if you got weed in your truck. You ought to lose the stickers. I'm not telling you that's the law. I'm just saying make it easy on yourself." "Don't have that problem down in Alabama."
The trooper looked up at the sky around the parking lot, peered at Lucas, lifted an arm and sniffed at his armpit, then said,
"You know, I'd swear this was Tennessee."
Harris didn't see the comedy in that and didn't smile, the short trooper told him.
"Get lost."
Harris got lost, tooling away in the stink of badly burned gasoline, his marijuana stickers intact. The tall trooper said,
"Dumbass," and asked Lucas, who had stepped away, "Who you're looking for?"
The guy's been on the run the last 10 years or so. Garvin Poole? Both troopers shook their heads.
What'd he do?
One of them asked. Everything, Lucas said, including killing a little girl and a Mississippi State trooper.
Okay, that's bad, said the short guy. You think he's close by?
Some of his family are, but Poole himself, I got no idea. I suspect he isn't, Lucas said. I'm just starting on him.
I know this area pretty good. I've been out here 8 years. I'll look him up, and if I have any ideas, I'll give you a buzz, the short guy said.
Lucas and the troopers talked for a few more minutes. The tall one was curious about how to get to be a marshal, and Lucas told him, "Fill out an application. There's a whole thing about it online." The trooper said he'd do that, and Lucas asked if there might be a decent rib joint around, and they pointed him to a roadside barbecue barn a few miles away. Lucas traded cards with them before they left, then went to eat. At 8 o'clock, the barbecue ribs sitting uneasily in his stomach. He was back at the Poole place, still no lights, still the aging Corolla parked in the driveway. Lucas pulled in behind it, got out, walked up the sidewalk. He knocked, got no answer. He knocked again, waited, then turned away and saw the heavy-set woman across the street behind her screen door. He went that way, and as he walked up her driveway, she called,
"Are you the police?"
"I'm a U.S. Marshal," Lucas said.
"What do you want with the Pools?" she asked.
"I need to interview them," Lucas said. "Nothing they've done wrong or anything. Have you seen them around?"
She stood silently for a moment, chewing on her lower lip. Then,
"I tell you what, sir, I was thinking I might call the local police. Marjorie's car been parked there all day like that, and Kevin's car is in the garage because I looked in the window and seen it. Hasn't been moved. They tell me when they go out of town, so I can keep an eye on the place, but I didn't hear a peep from them. I haven't seen anything moving over there all day, but they were there last night. I seen them and saw lights. Today I seen nothing. I knocked, but nobody answered. I'm a little worried."
Lucas said, "Huh." He looks back at the Poole house. "No lights?"
"That's another thing. They got those fake anti-burglar lights, you know, that automatically switch on and off with timers. They always use those when they're gone, and there haven't been any lights at all."
"Okay," Lucas said. "Listen, I'll call somebody, see if there's a way to check."
"I'd appreciate that, sir," she said.
Lucas went back to the Benz, started it up, and called Adams, the TBI investigator he'd spoken to on the phone. Adams was at home, babysitting for his wife, who was out with girlfriends. Lucas outlined the problem, and Adams said,
"You could go into the house without a warrant, on the basis of a neighbor's legitimate statement of concern, but, geez, I can't leave right now. I'm stuck here with the kids. I could call the office and see if we could get a couple guys down there."
Lucas remembered the two highway patrolmen and suggested that he call one of them. One of them said he lives out here, so he's probably close by.
"That'd work," Adams said. "They're authorized to do anything we do."
Lucas found the patrolman's cards and called the short one, whose name was Manny Dean.
"Manny, this is Davenport, the marshal you talked to earlier today."
"Oh, yeah. What's up, man?"
Lucas gave him a quick summary, and Dean said,
"I can be there in 15 minutes. Gotta put some pants on. Meet you out front."
Lucas went back to the Poole house. Under the nervous eyes of the woman across the street, he rang the bell again and knocked for a while, but got no response. Dean showed up wearing civilian clothes, but driving his patrol car. He got out with a flashlight and asked,
"Nothing?"
"Nothing. Let's see what we can see." The drapes had been pulled on the front picture windows, so they went around the house to the master bedroom and guest bedroom, where the drapes were open,
but both bedrooms appeared to be unoccupied. There was a tiny porch on the back of the house leading into a kitchen. Dean shone his light through the window, looked around, stepped back, frowned, went back to the window and said, "Hey." Lucas was on the burnt-out lawn looking up. "See something? Come here. Right over there by the archway going to the front." "Is that a leg?" Dean asked. "There's no body or anything, but is that a leg going across there? Could be a rolled-up piece of carpet, I guess, but it kind of looks like a leg." Lucas looked, then turned and said, "You got a tire iron in your car?" "Yeah, and a crowbar." "I think it's a leg. It may be too late, but we gotta go in." They went through the front door. Dean cracked it with the crowbar, and Lucas pushed the door open with a knuckle, and the smell of death hit him. Lucas turned and said, "Don't touch anything." The house was dark, and Lucas shone Dean's flashlight across the living room. A man was lying on the floor, his head propped up against an 80s stereo cabinet, a short-barreled revolver lying on the floor a yard or so from his right hand. There was a bullet hole in his forehead. Scanning across the room, Lucas spotlighted a woman's body which had been cut into pieces, fingers, thumbs, both feet, one hand, at which point she must have died from shock before the torturers could get the other hand. They'd quit there, leaving her on a blood-soaked shag carpet. Dean said, "That's not something you see on a routine basis." Lucas glanced at him. "If you're gonna barf, do it outside." Dean said, "I got 100 automobile accidents a year. Blood doesn't bother me none. Not anymore." "Okay, let's get the local cops over here and the TBI, Lucas said. "Back out. You get the locals. I'll call my guy at the TBI. More cops began arriving within 5 minutes of the call. First, the local cops, then the sheriff's deputies, and finally a TBI investigator named Lawrence Post. Post looked over the scene, asked the Laverne cops to set up a perimeter, and got a crime scene crew moving. He took Lucas aside and asked, "What's going on?" Lucas filled them in on Garvin Poole and added, "I think the cartel wants its money back." "If that's Ms. Poole in there, she must have told them everything she knew." "Maybe. I've got more bad news. Gar Poole has a sister who lives not too far from here, near a place called Beech Grove. She and her husband run a salvage yard. I got the details in my briefcase. We better get some people over there." "It's not too far," Lucas said. "I want to walk through here when you've finished processing it, but I'm going to run down there now. That'll be faster than calling in somebody who doesn't know what's going on." Dean had drifted up during the conversation and said, "I'm coming with you. I've got nothing to do here, and I got lights and a siren." "Let's go," Lucas said. He got his briefcase from the car and pulled out the paper on Poole's sister, Natalie Parker, and read the relevant bits to Dean. "Hey, I know them. Hard-working, but not entirely on the right side of the law," Dean said. "They've been known to chop a car now and then. How do you want to do this?" Lucas got his iPad from his truck and called up a satellite image of the Parker salvage yard. The yard covered several acres, with three buildings facing the road. Structure farthest down the road, Dean said, was the Parker residence. There were two buildings at the front of the yard, a small office building and a much larger Quonset hut. Dean thought the Quonset hut was a workshop, though he'd never been inside. "I've seen welding torches when I've gone by." Lucas touched the iPad screen. "We'll park here by this creek, go in on foot. You think the drug guys could be there?" "Don't know. The Pools haven't been dead all that long, probably killed this morning or maybe late last night, just on the basis of my nose. Whoever killed them probably isn't far away. I wouldn't want to guess wrong about them being at the Parker's place."
Dean's eyes drifted back to the pool house.
Got it.
Chapter 6 Lucas and Dean made it to the Parker Salvage Yard in 25 minutes, Dean leading with lights but no siren. Off the interstate, they threaded through a maze of rural blacktopped roads, almost like city alleys with trees tight on both sides, with Dean finally coasting to the shoulder. Lucas parked behind him. He could see lights a few hundred yards away, filtering through the roadside brush. They got out into the night, eased their car doors shut, locked them. Lucas had a miniature LED flashlight in one hand and his non-regulation 45 in the other. They scuffled 200 yards down the middle of the beat-up blacktop road. There was no traffic at all. The darkness was thick around them. They couldn't see their own feet, but Lucas didn't want to use the flash. They could smell water weeds from a roadside creek and cut grass and oil from the yard. Mosquitoes whined past their ears as they walked. At the salvage yard, they walked down the drive into a little more light, checked the office, which appeared to be empty. There were lights in the Quonset, and Lucas said, "Stay behind me, but don't shoot me in the back."
"That'd be embarrassing as hell,"
Dean whispered. He was nervous, his heavy revolver pointed straight up.
"Course you are a Yankee. I probably wouldn't actually get fired."
"Shh." They walked around the office and back to the Quonset. An overhead pole light cast an orange sodium vapor glow, giving the leaves from a nearby cottonwood a weird flickering black glow. As they approached the Quonset, Lucas held a finger up to Dean's face, stopping him, and he stepped sideways to a small square window and looked in. A woman and two men were working around what looked like a new Corvette under bright lights, pulling apart the front end. He watched for a moment as the three were apparently arguing about how to dismantle the front fender. Lucas cricked a finger at Dean, who stepped up and looked in for a second or two, then stepped back, whispering to himself. He caught Lucas's jacket sleeve and tugged him away.
"Back to the car," he whispered.
Lucas followed him around the office building again, and then Dean started jogging back toward their cars. When they got there, Dean pointed at the passenger side, got in the patrol car, and Lucas got in beside him. Dean was on his radio. He'd memorized the tag on the Corvette and asked that it be checked. His dispatcher came back a moment later and said,
"It's on the list, Manny. Belongs to a dentist. Got taken out of his parking lot between 3 and 4 o'clock this afternoon. The engine alone is worth $5,000. You got it?"
"Yeah, and there's a lot more going on, too. We could use some help down here. Call the sheriff's office and tell them to meet us at the Confederate Cemetery."
Off the radio, Dean said to Lucas,
"The drug guys haven't found them yet, if that's what's going on. But they're chopping that Corvette. That could give us some weight when it comes to getting Natalie to talk about her brother."
"When you're right," Lucas said. They did U-turns on the road, and Dean led the way to the edge of the town where he pulled to the shoulder. Lucas turned in behind him, and they both got out. Dean said,
"I'm starting to like this detecting shit. Tell the truth, I'm surprised that the drug guys haven't found them. They're supposed to be, like, you know, all seen."
"They're not. They're a bunch of jumped-up gang guys. Half of them can't even read," Lucas said. "They're not the FBI. They don't have the computer backup, the crime files. That's why they had to cut up Mrs. Poole."
"Then how'd they get onto the pools in the